Listening to the creak of the wagon beneath her, she closes her eyes and thinks about Jakob, remembering the night he'd come to say goodbye, the cool of his hands on her knees, the warmth of his breath on her fingers when he'd kissed them. It was the 8th of September, just a day after he set off for Lvov, when the Wehrmacht arrived in Radom. The Germans sent a single plane first, and Bella and her father tracked it as it flew low over the city, circling once before dropping an orange flare. "What does it mean?" Bella asked as the plane receded and then disappeared into a gray expanse of swollen, low-hanging clouds. Her father was silent. "Father, I'm a grown woman. Just tell me," Bella had said flatly. Henry looked away. "It means they're coming," he answered. And in his expression, the tight, downward curve of his mouth, the pleat of skin between his eyes, she saw something she'd never seen before. Her father was scared. An hour later, just as the rain began to fall, Bella watched from the window of her family's flat as rows upon rows of ground forces marched into Radom, unopposed. She heard them before she saw them, their tanks and horses and motorcycles rumbling in through the mud from the west. She held her breath as they came into view, at once afraid to watch and afraid to look away, her eyes glued to them as they rolled down Vitolde Boulevard in bottle-green uniforms and rain-speckled goggles, so powerful, so many of them. They swarmed the city's empty streets, and by nightfall, they occupied the government buildings, proclaiming the city theirs with emphatic Heil Hitlers as they hoisted their swastika flags. It was a sight Bella would never forget. Once the city was officially occupied, everyone was wary, Jews and Poles alike. But it was obvious from the start that the Jews were the Nazis' primary targets. Those who ventured out risked being harassed, humiliated, beaten. Radomers learned quickly to abandon the safety of their homes, only to run the most pressing errands. Bella left only once, to collect some bread and milk, detouring to the nearest Polish grocery, when she discovered that the Jewish market she used to frequent in the old quarter had been ransacked and closed. She kept to the back streets and walked with a quick, purposeful stride, but on her return, she had to step around a scene that haunted her for weeks. A rabbi, surrounded by Wehrmacht soldiers, his arms pinned behind his back, the soldiers laughing as the old man struggled in vain to free himself, his head thrashing violently from side to side. It wasn't until Bella passed him by that she realized with a sickening start that the rabbi's beard was on fire. A few days after the Germans took Radom, a letter arrived from Jakob. "My love," he wrote in hurried script, "come to Lvov as soon as you can. They've put us up in apartments. Mine is just big enough for two. I hate that you are so far away. I need you here. Please, come." Jakob included an address. Her parents, to her surprise, agreed to let her go. They knew how badly Bella missed Jakob. And at least in Lvov, Henry and Gustava reasoned, Bella and her sister Anna could look after one another. Pressing her father's hand to her cheek in gratitude, Bella was overcome with relief. The next day, she brought the letter to Jakob's father, Saul. Her parents didn't have the money to hire a driver. The Kurtzes, on the other hand, had the means and the connections, and she was sure they would be willing to help. At first, though, Saul opposed the idea. "Absolutely not. It's far too dangerous to travel alone," he said. "I cannot permit it. If anything happened to you, Jakob would never forgive me." Lvov hadn't fallen, but there was speculation that the Germans had the city surrounded. "Please," Bella begged. "It can't be any worse than it is here. Jakob wouldn't have asked me to come if he didn't feel it was safe. I need to be with him. My parents have agreed to it. Please, Pan Kurtz. Proszę." For 3 days, Bella petitioned her case to Saul, and for 3 days he refused. Finally, on the 4th day, he acquiesced. "I'll hire a wagon," he said, shaking his head as if disappointed in his decision. I hope I don't regret it. Less than a week later, the arrangements were made. Saul had found a pair of horses, a wagon, and a driver. A lithe old gentleman named Tomek, with bowed legs and a graying beard, who had worked for him over the summer and who knew the route well. Tomek was trustworthy, Saul said, and good with horses. Saul promised him that if he brought Bella safely to Lvov, he could keep the horses and wagon. Tomek was out of work and jumped at the offer. "Wear the things you want to take," Saul had said. "It will be less conspicuous." Civilian travel was still allowed in what was once Poland, but the Nazis issued new restrictions by the day. Bella wrote immediately to Jakob, telling him of her plans, and left the following day, wearing two pairs of silk stockings, a navy knee-length fluted skirt, a favorite of Jakob's, four cotton blouses, a wool sweater, her yellow silk scarf, a birthday gift from Anna, a flannel coat, and her gold brooch, which she hung on a chain around her neck and tucked into her shirt so the Germans wouldn't see it. She slipped a small sewing kit, a comb, and a family photo into her coat pocket beside the 40 zloty Saul insisted she bring. Instead of a suitcase, she carried Jakob's winter jacket and a hollowed loaf of peasant bread with his Rolleiflex camera hidden inside. They've crossed four German checkpoints since leaving Radom. At each, Bella tucked the bread loaf beneath her coat and feigned pregnancy. "Please," she begged, one hand resting on her belly, the other on the small of her back. "I must reach my husband in Lvov before the baby arrives." So far, the Wehrmacht has taken pity on her and waved the wagon on. Bella's head rocks gently on the bench as they plod eastward. 11 days. They have no radio and thus no access to the news, but they have grown accustomed to the menacing growl of Luftwaffe planes, the distant clap of explosives detonating over what they could only presume was Lvov. A few days ago, it sounded as if the city were under siege. Even more disconcerting, though, was the silence that followed. Had the city fallen, or were the Poles able to keep the Germans at bay? Bella wonders constantly if Jakob is safe. Surely he's been called upon to defend the city. Twice Tomek has asked Bella if she would like to turn back, to attempt the journey at a later date. But Bella insists they continue on. She told Jakob in her letter that she was coming. She must keep her promise. To quit now, despite the uncertainty ahead, would feel cowardly. "Whoa!" Tomek calls from the jockey box, and in an instant his voice is swallowed by shouts.
"Halt! Halt sofort!"
Bella sits up and swings her feet to the floor. Slipping the bread loaf into her coat, she pulls the wagon's canvas door aside. Outside, a swampy meadow teems with men in belted green tunics. Wehrmacht. There are soldiers everywhere. This is no checkpoint, Bella realizes. It must be the German front. A chill tiptoes up her vertebrae as three block-jawed soldiers with gray peaked caps and wood-stocked carabiners approach. Everything about them, their charged expressions, their rigid gait, their sharply creased uniforms, is unforgiving. Bella climbs out of the wagon and waits, willing herself to remain calm. The head soldier, gripping his rifle, raises his free hand and thrusts his palm in her direction.
"Ausweis!"
he orders. He turns his palm up to the sky.
"Papiere!"
Bella freezes. She knows very little German. Tomek whispers,
"Your papers, Bella."
A second soldier approaches the jockey box and Tomek hands him his papers, glancing over his shoulder at Bella. She is hesitant to hand over her ID, for it states clearly that she is Jewish, a truth that will likely do her more harm than good, but she has no other choice. She offers her identification card at arm's length and waits, holding her breath as the soldier scrutinizes it. unsure of where to look, her eyes dart from the insignia on his collar to the 6 black buttons running down the length of his tunic, to the words, Gott mit uns, inscribed across his belt buckle. These words Bella understands. God with us. Finally, the soldier looks up, his eyes as gray and merciless as the clouds overhead, and purses his lips.
Keine Zivilisten von diesem Punkt,
he snaps, handing her back her card. Something about civilians. Tomek slips his own papers into his pocket and gathers his reins.
Wait,
Bella breathes, a hand on her belly. But the head soldier cocks his rifle and juts his chin west, in the direction from which they'd come.
Keine Zivilisten! Nach Hause gehen!
As Bella opens her mouth to protest, Tomek shakes his head quickly, subtly. Don't. He's right. Whether or not they believe she's pregnant, these soldiers aren't about to bend any rules. Bella turns and heaves herself back into the wagon, defeated. Tomek pivots the horses on their haunches, and they begin to retrace their footsteps, plodding west, away from Lvov, away from Jakob. Bella's mind spins. She fidgets, too vexed to be still. Extracting the bread from her coat, she sets it on the bench and crawls to the rear door flap, opening it just enough to see out. The men in the meadow appear small, like toy soldiers, dwarfed by the colossal clouds looming above. She lets the heavy canvas fall and is enveloped again in shadows.
They've come so far. They're so close.
Bella presses her fingertips into the soft skin of her temples, searching for a solution. They could come back the next day, hope for better luck, a more lenient group of Germans. No, she shakes her head. They're at the front. What are the chances, really, that they be allowed through? Suddenly claustrophobic beneath all of her layers, she tugs off her flannel coat and scoots back up the bench to the front of the wagon, where another flap of canvas separates her from Tomek. Lifting it, she squints up at the jockey box. It's begun to drizzle.
Can we try again tomorrow?
Bella yells over the muted clop of hooves on the soggy road. Tomek shakes his head.
It won't work, he says.
Bella can feel heat rising in her, crawling up her neck toward her ears.
But we can't go back.
She glances at the provisions box at her feet.
We don't have enough food for another 11 days on the road.
She watches Tomek's shoulders rock back and forth, absorbing the sway of the wagon, his head bobbing as if he were drunk. He doesn't answer. Bella lets the canvas flap fall and slumps back onto the bench. She and Tomek haven't spoken much since leaving Radom. Bella had tried to make small talk at the start of the journey, but it felt odd conversing with someone she barely knew, and besides, there wasn't much to say. Surely Tomek must want to get to Lvov as badly as she. He's but a few kilometers from holding up his end of Saul's bargain. She'll remind him of this, she decides, but when she reaches again for the flap, the horses veer suddenly off-road. Gripping the bench beneath her, Bella braces herself as the wagon pitches and bucks over uneven ground.
What's happening? Where are we going?
Twigs snap like firecrackers beneath the wheels, and branches claw at the wagon's cover from above. They must be in the woods. Her mind turns a dark corner.
Tomek wouldn't leave her here, alone in the woods.
A simple lie would assure Saul he delivered her safely to Lvov.
Bella's heart sets off at a gallop.
No, she decides. Tomek wouldn't dare. But as the wagon lurches on, she can't help but wonder.
Or would he?
Finally, the horses slow to a halt, and Bella steps quickly out of the wagon. The sky has dimmed by several shades. Soon it will match the color of the horses' slick, black coats. Tomek climbs from the driver's bench. In his black hat and dark trench coat, he is barely visible in the shadows. Bella stares at him, her pulse still racing, as he begins unbridling the horses. Sorry for the silence, he says, slipping the bits from the horse's mouths. You never know who might be listening. Bella nods, waiting. We are about 3 kilometers from a back road that leads to Lvov, Tomek continues. There's a clearing up ahead, a meadow. I imagine it's unmanned, but you'll have to crawl across it to be safe. The grass should be tall enough to keep you out of sight. Bella squints in the direction of the clearing, but it's too dark to see anything. Tomek nods, as if reassuring himself his plan will work. Once you cross the meadow, you'll have to walk southeast through the forest for about an hour, and then you'll reach the road. By then I believe you'll have skirted the front. He pauses. Unless the Germans have the city surrounded. In which case, you'll have to wait for them to move ahead, or cross the front line on your own. Either way, he says, finally looking her in the eye. I think you're better off without me. Bella stares at Tomek, digesting the implication of his plan. To travel alone and on foot, it sounded outrageous. She would be mad to consider it. She can hear herself explaining the idea to Jakob, to his father. Their responses would be the same. Don't do it. Alternatively, we turn around and return as quickly as we can and search for some food along the way, Tomek says quietly. It would be the safer thing to go home, but Bella knows she can't. Her mind churns. She tries to swallow, but the back of her throat is like sandpaper, and instead she coughs. Tomek is right. Without the wagon, she'll be less conspicuous. And if she did run into Germans, they'd be more likely to let her by than they would an old man, a young woman, and a 2-horse wagon. She bites the inside corner of her bottom lip, silent for a minute. Tak, she says finally, looking in the direction of the clearing. Yes, she resolves. What other choice does she have? She's just a few hours from Lvov, from Jakob, her ukohani, her love. She can't turn back now. She rests a hand on the wagon's frame, her limbs suddenly heavy with the weight of her decision. If there are soldiers patrolling the meadow, she doubts she can make it across unnoticed. And if she does reach the other side, there's no telling who or what may be lurking beneath the forest canopy. Enough, she scolds silently. You've come this far. You can do this. Tak, she breathes, nodding. Yes, this will work. It has to work. All right then, Tomek says quietly. All right then. Bella runs a hand over her auburn hair, thick as wool from so many days without a wash. She'd given up trying to pull a comb through it. She clears her throat. I leave now. You'll be better leaving in the morning, Tomek says, when it's not so dark. I'll stay with you until dawn. Of course, she'll need the daylight to find her way. Thank you, Bella whispers, realizing that Tomek too has a treacherous journey ahead. She climbs back into the wagon, rummaging around the provisions box for the last of their hard-boiled eggs. When she finds it, she peels it and returns to Tomek. Here, she says, breaking it in half. Tomek hesitates before taking it. Thank you. Tell Pan Kurtz you did everything you could to get me to Lvov. If, she straightens, when I make it, I'll write to let him know I'm safe. I will. Bella nods, and there is a silence between them as she contemplates what she has just agreed to. Will Tomek wake up and come to his senses, realizing that the plan was too risky? Would he try to talk her out of it in the morning? Get some rest, Tomek offers, as he turns back to the horses. Bella forces a smile. I'll try. As she steps back up into the wagon, she pauses. Tomek, she calls, feeling guilty for questioning his intentions. Tomek looks up. Thank you for getting us this far. Tomek nods. Good night, then, Bella says. Inside the wagon, Bella flattens Jakob's overcoat out on the floor and climbs on top, stretching out onto her back. Bringing a palm to her heart and the other to her abdomen, she inhales and exhales slowly, willing herself to relax. It's the right decision, she tells herself, blinking into the darkness. The next morning, Bella awakens at daybreak from a light, restless sleep. Rubbing her eyes, she fumbles for the wagon's side door flap. Outside, a few dense rays of light have begun to sift through the clouds, just barely illuminating the spaces between the tree limbs overhead. Tomek has already rolled up his tent and sleeping mat and harnessed the horses. He nods in her direction, then returns to his work. Apparently, he hasn't had a change of heart. Bella slips a boiled potato into her pocket, leaving three for Tomek. After buttoning her coat, and then Jakob's over hers, she reaches for the bread loaf and climbs out of the wagon. As onerous as the journey ahead may be, she won't mind leaving behind the cramped, mildewed space she's called home for the better part of 2 weeks. Tomek is tinkering with one of the horse's bridles. As Bella approaches, she finds herself wishing she knew him better, well enough at least to part with a hug, an embrace of some kind that would boost her strength, fill her with the courage she'd need to go through with the plan. But she doesn't. She barely knows him at all. I want to tell you how much I appreciate what you've done for me, she says, extending a hand. It's important to her all of a sudden to acknowledge the small but immeasurably important role Tomek has played in her life. He takes her hand. His grip is surprisingly strong. Beside them, the horses grow restless. One of them shakes his head and his bit jingles. The other snorts, paws the ground. They, too, are ready to reach the end of their journey. Oh, Tomek, I nearly forgot, Bella adds, fishing a 10 zloty bill from her pocket. You'll need some food. A couple of potatoes won't do. She holds the zloty out for him. Take it, please. Tomek glances at his feet and then back up at Bella. He takes the note. Good luck to you, Bella offers.
Same to you. God bless.
Bella nods and then turns and begins making her way under the cover of the forest toward the meadow. After a few minutes, she reaches the edge of the clearing and pauses, scanning the open space for a sign of life. The meadow, as far as she can tell, is empty. She glances over her shoulder to see if Tomek is watching. But beneath the oak trees, there are only empty shadows. Has he already left? She shivers as she realizes just how alone she is.
You agreed to this, she reminds herself. You're better off alone.
She hikes her skirt up over her knees, ties it in a loose knot at her thigh, and then tucks the bread loaf under Jakob's coat and adjusts it so the loaf rests on her back. There, now she can move more easily. Squatting, she brings her palms and then her knees silently to the ground. The earth beneath her squishes as she crawls, the cold mud curling between her fingers, painting her extremities tar black. The grass is long and sharp and damp with dew. It slices relentlessly at her face and neck. Within minutes, one of her cheeks is bleeding, and she is soaked all the way through to her undergarments. Ignoring the mud and the wet and the sting on her cheek, she kneels for a moment to scan the tree line 100 meters ahead, and then glances over her shoulder. Still no sign of Germans. Good. She lowers herself back onto her hands, wishing she'd worn trousers, realizing now what a pointless vanity it was to want to look nice for Jakob. As she sloshes her way across the meadow, she thinks of her parents and the meal they'd shared the night before she left. Her mother had prepared boiled pierogi stuffed with mushrooms and cabbage, Bella's favorite, which she and her father had devoured. Gustava, however, had barely touched the food on her plate. Bella's chest tightens as she pictures her mother with an uneaten pierogi before her. She'd always been thin, but since the Germans arrived, she'd grown gaunt. Bella had blamed it on the stress of war, and it had pained her to leave, seeing her mother so frail. She recalls how, the following day, as she boarded Tomek's wagon, she glanced up at the flat and saw her parents standing at the window. Her father, with an arm wrapped around her mother's slight frame, her mother with her palms pressed up against the glass. All she could make out were their silhouettes, but she could tell from the way Gustava's shoulders shook that she was crying. She'd wanted badly to wave, to leave her parents with a smile that said she'd be fine, she'd be back, not to worry. But Vitolda Boulevard was crawling with Wehrmacht. She couldn't risk revealing her departure with a wave. Instead, she turned away, pulled the wagon's door flap aside, and climbed in. Bella winces as her knee strikes something hard, a rock. She breathes through the pain and crawls on, realizing just how quickly the events of the past 2 weeks have unfolded. Jakob's departure, the German invasion, the letter, the arrangement with Tomek. She'd been frantic when she left Radom, thinking solely of getting to Lvov to be with Jakob. But what about her parents? Will they be all right on her own? What if something happens to them while she's away? How will she help them? What if something happens to her? What if she never makes it to Lvov? Stop, she scolds. You will be fine. Your parents will be fine. She recites the sentiment over and over again, until the possibility of any other scenario is removed from her consciousness. Bella tries to listen for signs of danger as she crawls, but her ears are filled with the thunder of her pulse. She'd have never guessed that walking on her hands and knees would require such work. Everything is heavy. Her arms, her legs, her head. It's as if she's anchored to the earth, weighed down by her appendages, by her countless layers of clothing, by Jakob's camera, by the muscle that clings to her bones, and the sweat that coats her skin despite the morning chill. Her joints hurt, every one of them. Her hips, her elbows, her knees, her knuckles. They grow stiffer by the minute. Damn the mud. Pausing, she wipes her forehead with the back of her hand and peers over the tips of the grass. She's halfway to the tree line. 50 meters to go. You're nearly there, she tells herself, resisting the urge to lie down for a few minutes to rest. Can't stop now. Rest when you reach the forest. Focusing on the cadence of her breath, 2 beats in through her nose, 3 beats out through her mouth, Bella is lost in delirious rhythm when a sharp crack catapults through the morning sky, splintering the silence. She drops quickly to her stomach and flattens her body to the ground, shielding the back of her head with her hands. There is no mistaking what the sound was. A gunshot. Would there be another? Where had it come from? Are they onto her? She waits, every muscle in her body flexed, contemplating what to do. Run? Or remain hidden? Her instinct tells her to play dead, and so she lies, her nose a centimeter from the mud, breathing in the smell of fear and wet earth, counting the seconds as they pass. A minute ticks by, then 2 as she listens, straining, the meadow playing tricks on her. Was that the wind rustling the grass, or was it footsteps? Finally, when she can't stand it any longer, Bella presses her palms into the mud and in slow motion lifts her torso. Through the grass, she scans the horizon. From what she can see, it's clear. Maybe the shot had sounded closer than it was. Ignoring the likelihood that it had come from the direction in which she is headed, she starts crawling again, faster now, her muscles no longer heavy with fatigue, but spiked with a terrifying sense of urgency.
You can do this. You're not far. Just be there when I arrive, Jacob, at the address you sent. Wait for me.
With each breath, she repeats the words.
Please, Jacob, just be there.
September 12, 1939. Battle of Lvov. The battle for control of the city begins with clashes between Polish and surrounding German forces, which greatly outnumber the Poles in both infantry and weaponry. The Poles sustain nearly 2 weeks of ground fighting, shelling, and bombing by the Luftwaffe. September 17, 1939. The Soviet Union cancels all pacts with Poland and invades the country from the east. The Red Army begins marching at full tilt toward Lvov. The Poles push back, but by the 19th of September, the Soviets and the Germans have the city surrounded.
Chapter 5. Mila. Radom, Poland. September 20th, 1939. The moment Mila opens her eyes, she can sense it. Something isn't right. The apartment is too still, too quiet. Taking a sharp breath, she sits up, her spine straight. Felicia. She climbs out of bed and hurries barefoot down the hall to the nursery. The door swings open without a sound, and Mila blinks into the darkness, realizing that she'd forgotten to check the clock. She pads silently to the window, and as she draws the thick damask curtain aside, a shaft of soft, powdery light fills the room. It must be dawn. Through the wooden bars of Felicia's crib, she can vaguely make out the lump of a silhouette. She tiptoes to the crib rail. Felicia lies on her side, motionless, her face obscured by the pink coats draped over her ear. Mila reaches down, lifts the small cotton blanket, and rests her palm gently on the back of Felicia's head, waiting intently for a breath, a rustle, anything. Why is it, Mila wonders, that even when her daughter is sleeping, she worries that something dreadful has happened to her? Finally, Felicia flinches, sighs, and rolls to her other side. Within seconds, she is still again. Mila exhales. She slips out of the room, leaving the door ajar. Running her fingers along the wall, she makes her way quietly to the kitchen, glancing at the clock at the end of the hallway. It's just before 6 in the morning. Dorota, Mila calls softly. On most mornings, she awakens to the whistle of the kettle as Dorota prepares her tea, but it's still early. Dorota, who stays during the week in the small maid's quarters off the kitchen, doesn't typically start her day until 6:30. She must be asleep. Dorota, Mila calls again, knowing she shouldn't wake her, but she can't shake the sensation that something is wrong. Perhaps, Mila rationalizes, she's still adjusting to the feeling of waking up without Selim by her side. It's been nearly 2 weeks since her husband, along with Genek, Jakob, and Adam, was sent off to Lvov to join the Polish army. Selim promised he would write as soon as he arrived, but she hasn't received a letter yet. Mila follows the news in Lvov obsessively. The city, from what the papers report, is under siege. And as if the Germans weren't enough of a threat, 2 days ago, radios blared news of the Soviet Union allying with Nazi Germany. What peace pacts they'd established with Poland have been broken, and now Stalin's Red Army is said to be approaching Lvov from the east. Surely the Poles will soon be forced to surrender. Secretly, she hopes they do. Then perhaps her husband will come home. When Selim first left Radom, Mila fought sleep, for when she succumbed to it, she awoke in a cold sweat, shaking with fear, convinced that her bloody nightmares were real. One night it was Selim, the next it was one of her brothers, their bodies mangled, their uniforms soaked in gore. Mila was on the brink of unraveling when Dorota, whose son had also been called up, rescued her from her downward spiral.
"You mustn't think like that," she scolded one morning as Mila picked at her breakfast after another fitful night. "Your husband is a medic. He won't be at the front. And your brothers are smart. They'll take care of one another. Be positive, for your sake and for hers," she said, nodding toward the nursery.
"Dorota," Mila calls a third time, switching on the light to the kitchen, noticing the kettle resting cold on the stovetop. She knocks softly on Dorota's door, but the tap-tap of her knuckles against wood is met with silence. She rattles the knob and nudges the door open, peers inside. The room is empty. Dorota's sheets and blanket are folded and stacked into a neat pile at the foot of her bed. A lone nail protrudes from the far wall where a beveled crucifix once hung, and the small shelves Salim had installed are bare, except for one, which holds a slip of paper folded in half and propped up in the shape of a tent. Mila rests a hand on the doorway, her legs suddenly weak. After a minute, she forces herself to pick up the note and unfold it. Dorota has left her with two words. "Shukromi." "I'm sorry." Mila claps a hand to her mouth. "What have you done?" she whispers, as if Dorota were beside her, wrapped in her food-stained apron, her silver-streaked hair pulled tight into a pincushion bun. Mila has heard rumors of other maids leaving, some to flee the country before it fell into the hands of the Germans, some simply because the families they worked for were Jewish. But she hadn't considered the possibility that Dorota would abandon her. Salim paid her well, and she seemed genuinely happy in her job. There has never been a crossword between them, and she adores Felicia. More than all of that, though, was the fact that in the past 10 months, as Mila struggled with new motherhood, Dorota had become not simply a maid to her, she'd become a friend. As Mila lowers herself slowly to sit, Dorota's mattress coils moan beneath her. "But what will I do without you?" she wonders, her eyes filling slowly with tears. Radom is in shambles. She needs an ally now more than ever. She rests her palms on her knees and drops her chin, feeling the weight of her head tugging at the muscles between her shoulder blades. First Selim, her brothers, Adam, now Dorota. Gone. A seed of panic sprouts somewhere deep in her gut, and her pulse quickens. How will she manage, fending for herself? The Wehrmachtsmen have proved to be brutes, and they've shown no sign of leaving anytime soon. They've desecrated the beautiful brick synagogue on Podvalna Street, robbed it clean, and converted it to stables. They've closed each of the Jewish schools. They've frozen Jewish bank accounts and forbidden Poles from conducting business with Jews. Every day another shop is boycotted. First it was Friedman's Bakery, then Bergman's Toy Store, then Fogelman's Shoe Repair. Everywhere she looks, there are massive red swastika banners. "Judaism is criminality," billboards depicting hideous caricatures of hook-nosed Jews, windows painted over with the same four-letter word, as if Jude were some kind of curse, rather than part of a person's identity. Part of her identity. Before, she would have called herself a mother, a wife, an accomplished pianist. But now, she is nothing more than, simply, Jude. She can't go out anymore without seeing someone being harassed on the street or pulled from their home and robbed and beaten for no apparent reason. Things she had taken for granted, like walking to the park with Felicia in tow, leaving the apartment at all for that matter, are unsafe. It has been Dorota lately who has ventured out for food and supplies. Dorota who has retrieved her mail from the post office. Dorota who has delivered notes to and from her parents' house on Warszawska Street. Mila stares at the floor, listening to the faint tick of the clock in the hallway, the sound of seconds passing. In 3 days, it will be Yom Kippur. Not that it matters. The Germans have dropped leaflets throughout the city with a statement forbidding the Jews from holding services. They'd done the same at Rosh Hashanah, although Mila had ignored the mandate and snuck after dark to her parents' home. She regretted it later when she heard stories of others who'd done the same and been discovered. One man her father's age was made to run through the city center carrying a heavy stone over his head. Others were forced to haul metal bed frames from one end of town to the other while being flogged with meter-long clubs. One young man was trampled to death. This Yom Kippur, Mila had decided, she and Felicia would atone in the safety of their apartment, alone. What now? Tears spilled down her cheeks. She sobbed silently, too paralyzed to wipe her eyes, her nose. Looking around the empty room, she knows she should be furious. Dorota has left her. But she isn't angry. She's terrified. She's lost the one person under her roof she can trust, confide in, rely upon. A person who seemed to understand far better than she how to care for her child. Mila wishes she could ask Selim what to do. It was Selim, after all, who insisted that they hire Dorota when Felicia was a newborn and Mila was at her wit's end. Mila had resisted at first, her pride too great to submit to relying on a stranger to help parent her child. But in the end, Selim had been right. Dorota was her savior. And now Mila is once again in crisis, but without her husband's steady hand to guide her. The reality of her situation washes over her swiftly, and Mila shivers. Her safety, and with it Felicia's, now rests entirely in her own hands. Bile rises up in her throat, and she can taste it, sharp and acrid. Her stomach constricts as a pair of images flashes before her. The first, a photo she'd seen in the Tribune, taken shortly after Czechoslovakia fell, of a Moravian woman weeping, one arm dutifully raised in a Nazi salute. The second, a scene from one of her nightmares, a soldier in green, tearing Felicia from her arms. Oh, dear God, please don't let them take her away from me. Mila gags. Her vomit lands on the linoleum between her feet with a wet slap. Pinching her eyes shut, she coughs, fighting another wave of nausea, and with it, a pang of regret. What were you thinking, being in such a hurry to start the family? She and Selim were married for less than 3 months when they discovered that she was pregnant. She was so confident at the time. There was nothing she wanted more than to raise a child. Multiple children. An orchestra of children, she used to joke. And then Felicia was such a fussy baby, and motherhood took so much more out of her than she was expecting. And now, there is war. Had she known that before Felicia's first birthday, Poland might no longer exist? She gags again, and in that awful, noxious moment, she knows what she has to do. Her parents had asked her to move back to Warszawska Street when Selim left for Lwów, but Mila had opted to stay put. This apartment was her home now, and besides, she didn't want to be a burden. The war would be over soon, she said. Selim would return, and they'd pick up where they left off. She and Felicia could manage on their own, she'd argued, and besides, she had Dorota. But now... Felicia's cry shatters the silence, and Mila jumps. Mopping her mouth with the sleeve of her gown, she tucks Dorota's note into her pocket and stands, reaching for the wall to steady herself when the room begins to spin. Breathe, Mila. She'll clean up later, she decides, stepping carefully over the puddle on the floor. In the kitchen, she rinses her mouth and splashes cold water over her face. Coming, love! She calls when Felicia wails again. Felicia is standing at the crib rail, gripping it tightly with both hands, her quartz resting on the floor below her. When she sees her mother, she smiles brightly, revealing four tiny tooth buds, two each in her top and bottom gums. Mila's shoulders soften. "Good morning, sweet girl," she whispers, handing Felicia her blanket and lifting her from the crib. 2 months ago, when Mila weaned her from her breast, Felicia had begun sleeping through the night. With the extra rest, mother and daughter both had turned a corner. Felicia was a happier baby, and Mila no longer felt as if she were teetering on the edge of insanity. Felicia wraps her arms around her mother's neck, and Mila relishes the weight of her daughter's cheek, warm against her chest. "This is what I was thinking," she reminds herself. "This." "I've got you," she whispers, one hand on Felicia's back. Lifting her head, Felicia turns toward the window and points a tiny index finger. "Eh?" she intones, the sound she makes when she's curious about something. Mila follows her gaze. "Tam," she says. "Outside?" "Ta," Felicia imitates. Mila walks to the window to play her usual game of pointing out all the things she can see. Four speckled pigeons perched by a chimney, the opaque white globe of a street lantern. Across the way, three arched stone doorways, and above them, three large wrought iron balconies, a pair of horses pulling a carriage. Mila ignores the swastika flag hanging from an open window, the graffitied storefronts, the newly repainted street sign. She no longer lives on Jeromskiego, but on Reichstrasse. As Felicia watches the horses plod by below her, Mila kisses the top of her forehead, letting the down of Felicia's cinnamon hair, what there is of it, tickle her nose. "Your papa must miss you so much," she whispers, thinking of how Salim could make Felicia laugh by nuzzling his nose into her hair and pretending to sneeze. "He'll come home to us soon. Until then, it's you and me," she adds, trying to ignore the tang of bile still sharp in her throat as she processes the enormity of her words. Felicia looks up at her, wide-eyed, almost as if she understands, then brings her quartz to her ear and rests her cheek once again on Mila's chest. Later today, Mila decides she'll pack up some clothes and her toothbrush, Felicia's quartz and a pile of diapers, and walk the 6 blocks to her parents' house at 14 Warszawska. It's time. Chapter 6. Adi. Toulouse, France. September 21st, 1939. Adi is tucked away at a cafe overlooking the Place du Capitole's giant square, a spiral-bound pad of music paper open before him. He sets his pencil down and massages a cramp from the muscle between his thumb and forefinger. It's become his routine to spend his weekends parked at a bistro table, writing. He no longer travels to Paris. It feels too frivolous to get lost in the revelry of Montmartre's nightlife with his homeland at war. Instead, he devotes himself to his music and to his weekly trips to the Polish consulate in Toulouse, where he's been trying for months to secure a travel visa, the paperwork required for him to return to Poland. So far, the effort has been exasperatingly fruitless. On his first visit in March, 3 weeks before Passover, the clerk took one look at Addie's passport and shook his head, pushing a map across his desk and pointing to the country separating Adi from Poland: Germany, Austria, Czechoslovakia. "You will not make it past the checkpoints," he said, tapping his finger on the line of Addie's passport marked Religia. "Jid," the designation read, short for Żydowski, Jewish. His mother had been right, Addie realized, hating himself for doubting her. Not only was it too dangerous for him to travel across German borders, it was apparently illegal. Even so, Addy had returned to the consulate time after time, hoping to convince the clerk to grant him some sort of exemption, to wear him down with persistence. But at each visit, he was told the same. Not possible. And so, for the first time in his 25 years, he'd missed Passover in Radom. Rosh Hashanah had come and gone as well. When he isn't at work or writing home or composing his music or badgering the secretaries of the consulate, Addy pores over the headlines of La Dépêche de Toulouse. Every day as the war escalates, his anxiety heightens. This morning, he'd read that the Soviet Red Army was rolling through Poland from the east and had made an attempt to seize Lvov. His brothers are in Lvov. According to his mother, they'd been conscripted along with the rest of Radom's young men into the army. Any day now, it seems, the city will fall. Poland will fall. What will become of Genek and Jakob, of Adam and Salim? What will become of Poland? Addy is stuck. His life, his decisions, his future. None of it is in his control. It's a feeling to which he is unaccustomed, and he hates it. Hates the fact that he has no way of getting home, no way of reaching his brothers. At least, thankfully, he is in contact with his mother. They write each other often. In her last letter, which she'd sent just days after Radom fell, she'd described the heartbreak of bidding Genek and Jakob goodbye on the night they left for Lvov. How painful it was to see Halina and Mila do the same for Adam and Salim, and what it was like to watch the Germans march into Radom. The city was occupied within hours, she said. There are Wehrmacht soldiers everywhere. Addy thumbs through his pages, skimming his work, grateful for the distraction of his music. This, at least, is his. No one can take it from him. Since Poland went to war, he has written doggedly, nearly completing a new composition for piano, clarinet, and double bass. Closing his eyes, he taps out a chord on an imaginary keyboard resting on his lap, wondering whether it has potential. He's had one commercial success already, a piece recorded by the talented singer Vera Gran that tells the story of a young man writing home to a loved one. Liszt, the letter. Addy composed Liszt just before leaving Poland for university, and will never forget how it felt to hear the song for the first time on the air, how he'd closed his eyes and listened to the melody he'd created as it spilled from his radio speakers, how his chest had swelled with pride when his name was announced afterward, crediting him as composer. Perhaps Liszt, he'd fantasized at the time, was the piece that would eventually lead to a vocation in music. Liszt was a hit in Poland, so much so that Addy had come to be something of a celebrity in Radom, which of course provoked constant teasing from his siblings. "Brother, an autograph, please," Genek would call after him when Addy was home for a visit. At the time, Addy didn't mind the attention, or the fact that in his handsome older brother's ribbing, he sensed a hint of envy. His siblings were happy for him, no doubt. Proud of him, too. They'd watched him compose since his toes barely reached the pedals of his parents' baby grand. They understood how much this first break meant for him. It was Addy's big city life, he knew, that his brother secretly coveted. Genek had visited Toulouse, had met Addy once in Paris. Each time, he'd left mumbling about how glamorous Addy's life in France seemed in comparison with his own. Now, of course, things are different. Now, there is nothing glamorous about living in a country where Addy is virtually imprisoned. Even with his hometown overrun by Germans, Addy would do anything to return. In the square, the last few bits of daylight cast a rose-colored glow over the marble-columned facade of the capital. Addy watches a flock of pigeons take flight as an old woman makes her way toward a series of roofed arcades to the west, and he is reminded of an evening last summer when he and his friends had sat at sundown at a cafe in a similar square in Montmartre, sipping glasses of Semillon. Addie replays the conversation from that evening, recalling how, when the subject of war arose, his friends had rolled their eyes.
"Hitler is un bouffon," they'd said. "All this talk of war is just a fuss, une agitation. Nothing will come of it. Le dictateur déteste le jazz," one friend had professed. "He hates jazz even more than he hates the Jews. Can't you just see him walking around Place de Clichy with his hands over his ears?"
The table had erupted in laughter. Addie had laughed along with them. Reaching for his pencil, he returns to his pad of paper. He plots a melodic phrase, and then another, writing quickly, willing his pencil to keep up with the music in his head. 2 hours pass. Around him, tables begin to fill with men and women settling in for their evening meal, but Addie hardly notices. When he finally looks up, the sky has darkened to a deep periwinkle blue. It's getting late. He pays his bill, folds his pad of paper under his arm, and walks across the square to his apartment on Rue de Remusat. He enters the courtyard of his building, unlocks his mailbox, and rifles quickly through a small sheaf of letters. Nothing from home. Disappointed, he climbs 4 flights of stairs, hangs up his cap, and removes his shoes, arranging them neatly on a straw mat by the door. He drops his mail on the table, flips on the radio, and fills a kettle with water, setting it on the stovetop to boil. His place is small and tidy, with only 2 rooms, a tiny bedroom and a kitchen just big enough for a bistro table, but it suits him. He's the only one of his 4 siblings who is still single, despite his mother's prodding. Opening his icebox, he peruses its contents: 1 ounce of creamy camembert, 1/2 liter of goat's milk, 2 speckled eggs, a red Malou apple, the kind his mother used to set out for a snack when he was little, sliced and drizzled with honey. Addie likes to keep one always within reach. A sliver of steamed cow tongue wrapped in butcher paper, 1/2-eaten bar of dark Swiss chocolate. He reaches for the chocolate. Careful not to tear it, he peels back the silver foil and breaks off a square of the bittersweet cocoa, letting it melt for a moment in his mouth.
"Merci la Suisse," he whispers as he sits down at the table.
At the top of his pile of mail is the latest jazz hot review. Addie skims the headlines. "Strayhorn joins Ellington in composition partnership," one of them reads, 2 of his favorite jazz composers. He makes a mental note to keep an eye out for their work. Beneath Jazz Hot is a pale blue slip of paper he'd missed earlier. When he sees it, his heart skips, and the remnants of chocolate suddenly taste sharp on his tongue. He picks it up, turns it over. Typed across the top are 3 words. "Commande de conscription." It is a military conscription order. Addie reads the slip twice. He has been ordered to join a Polish column of the French army. He is to report immediately to l'Hôpital de la Grève to complete his medical exam and paperwork. His duty will begin in Parthenay, France, on November 6. Addie sets the order on the table and stares at it for a long while. The army. And to think that this morning he was lamenting for his brothers, grappling with the thought of them in uniform, terrified of their fate. Now, his circumstances are no different from theirs. Addie's ears start to ring, and it takes him a moment to realize that the water has begun to boil. He rises to switch off the burner, running a hand through his hair. As the kettle's whistle grows faint, Addie is struck by how quickly things can change in this new realm of his. How, in an instant, his future can be decided for him. Retrieving the conscription notice, he makes his way to the kitchen window overlooking the corner of the Place du Capitole, presses his forehead against the glass. Sidney Bechet's clarinet sings softly through his radio speakers, but he is oblivious.
The army,